Buttigieg announces a presidential run. The federal government shutdown might hit pause. That plus a civics test requirement and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 25th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg made official what many have long speculated: he'll make a bid for president in 2020. The 37-year-old Democrat made his announcement via a video to supporters that touts his work revitalizing South Bend.
Good leadership brings out the best in us. The job of a leader is to call us to our highest values.
We stand for the better America that we know we can be. That's our message. It's not even complicated.
Buttigieg is a Rhodes Scholar who was first elected mayor of his hometown in 2011 at age 29, making him the youngest mayor of a U.S. city with at least 100,000 residents. He served a tour of duty in Afghanistan while mayor in 2014 as a member of the Navy Reserve. And in addition to being the youngest candidate who's so far announced a White House bid for 2020, Buttigieg also becomes the first openly gay major party presidential candidate. What is Buttigieg's best path forward? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, it would be unusual to go from mayor to the White House, but can we rule it out in the current political climate?
Well, there are a few presidents who've been mayors, but they also were later legislators, congressmen, and governors before they made it to the White House. So I don't think that it's very likely, but it's not a bad play. I think that he's probably more interested in building a national profile in hopes that at some point, if Democrats get the White House back, he may have some position in an administration. I mean, I think that's what he's probably looking to more, but I don't think he's probably going to be president anytime soon.
Let me put it this way. I think that's the consensus, is that this is a run for vice president or a cabinet post or something like that. But if president is possible, how does Pete Buttigieg do it?
Well, first of all, he's more than a mayor. He's also served in the Afghan War, has served in the Navy on a counterterrorism intelligence team. And I would also argue that qualities of mayors are not necessarily something to be written off. They solve very complex problems in real time. They answer in real time to their constituents. So I think that's a fresh perspective that he'll be able to sell. I think that the American public is looking for someone who will bring people together over their common purpose, not their common pain. I think he has the ability to do that, and I think his freshness is actually an advantage.
Whether the goal is to build a national profile and potentially get a job or to be president itself, this is going to be a crowded Democratic field. So how does Pete Buttigieg stand out?
I mean, the fact is he's young. I'm not inside his head, but I think that he probably knows he's not going to be president in 2020. But he wants to be part of the national conversation. He wants to talk about the future of the party and the country. And if that, and it probably will, raises his national profile in a way that he can contribute some other way, I mean, I think that's positive for Indiana and him.
He's said he's going to serve out his term as mayor, at least at this point. We'll see if that holds. But again, if you're Pete Buttigieg, what do you do now to make sure that you're not just one of dozens who seem to be running for president on the Democratic side?
Well, it seems to me the strategy is the one he's adopted, which is, in addition to talking about his brain power and his military service, he talks about, I'm not a stranger to government and politics because of my service as a mayor. And that probably is a plus because that governmental service didn't take place in a place called Washington, D.C. So in many ways, as has been suggested, the executive branch experience that comes with being a mid-sized city's mayor is in many ways analogous to, on a much smaller scale, albeit, than what you would see needed in the White House. It's dealing with the legislative branch, in this case, the city council. It's dealing with constituents who have very clear wants and needs at the municipal level. And also the benefit is it's not, usually mayoral positions are not overtly political or in terms of partisanship. So you have the benefit of being a skilled tactician in terms of making government work and improving the community that you lead without leaving a trail of a lot of comments that would alienate roughly 50% of the electorate. Having said all that, it is still going to be tough. And I would point out as an example, we have a flurry of candidates now throwing their hat into the ring, and we've seen they're not all treated the same. Let's say CNN, in terms of national profile, when Elizabeth Warren threw her hat in, there was an hour-long town hall meeting that CNN carried live. Kamala Harris, the senator from California, just threw her hat in, and I think Monday night CNN has already scheduled one. I haven't seen the one-hour special scheduled for Pete Buttigieg yet. Maybe it's exploratory, but I'm sure it's coming.
All right. Well, the longest partial federal government shutdown in history stretched beyond a month this week, though there's now at least a temporary reprieve in sight. The U.S. Senate took two votes this week that aimed to end the shutdown, but neither President Trump's proposal or a temporary solution reached the necessary number of votes. That's as one of the latest skirmishes in the stalemate centered over the State of the Union. Trump wanted to go ahead with it next week, while Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi blocked him from doing so in the House chamber until the shutdown ended. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of federal workers have missed paychecks, setting off ripple effects throughout the economy. Banks across the country have offered those impacted by the government shutdown interest-free loans, including Evansville-based Old National Bank. The state already gave out its food stamp allotments for February, with no more assistance to come until the shutdown ends. So almost literally as we taped our show today, President Trump spoke at the White House saying he would sign a temporary deal, a clean deal without a lot of the bells and whistles, to open the government for 3 weeks, one that would end February 15th. So with that in mind, Elise Schrock, is this the light at the end of the tunnel now?
I don't think certainty is anything that is not a word that anyone's using, especially when you're also using the word temporary. I don't think there was an end game when this original threat to shut down the government came from President Trump. I don't think he had a plan. I think a plan has been maybe forced his way at this point with hundreds of thousands of federal workers going without paychecks. The public pressure is on him. I don't think it's the light at the end of the tunnel.
So are we just back to the same problem in 3 weeks?
Well, it's certainly possible. You know, if you remember a week ago, the president offered a compromise and Speaker Pelosi rejected it before he had even stated what it was. And so I think Democrats wrongly believe that the shutdown benefits them in some way in taking a stand and not being willing to compromise on anything. President Trump has offered compromise and the Democrats have said no matter what. I'm glad, as I'm sure everyone is, for this temporary situation so that we can get people paid as they should be. I mean, that whole system is messed up. It shouldn't be structured that way. The people who should not be getting paid are the ones who are working on these bills or not working on these bills, not the people who are running all the day-to-day operations that we all need. So where are we on February 15th? I don't know. If we don't get some sort of border security funding, then I think we're not going to get there. And I don't think that Democrats are wise to continue it because
I don't think they're glad about a shutdown, though. To say that
the public pressure is on
everyone, political implications,
it's not a partisan issue. Everyone wants to see a compromise happen, and compromise means both sides giving, which Republicans have been willing to do and Democrats thus far are not.
Let me ask this, though. There is perhaps no campaign promise more synonymous with the president than the wall, whatever that is. And Democrats just won, they picked up 40 seats in the House as border security and the wall was a central theme in the campaign in the last few weeks. So if you're those two sides, your base clearly want very different things, it seems. So how do you bridge that?
It's all about framing. I mean, I would say that even though a physical wall construction is not underway, I do hear carpenters framing and reframing, figuratively, how this issue is being viewed and presented to the public. And I think that's why the battle here is not as simple as, is there funding for a wall and is it $5.7 billion? We have to define, and this is part of the framing, what is the wall? Now we saw the president saying, I never wanted a concrete wall. I just wanted some see-through, transparent barrier.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm sure, in the next 24 hours, any number of video segments will appear of him talking about what constituted his big, beautiful wall, which sounded more like concrete than it did translucent or
steel slats.
So it's all how this is framed. And that's why almost it really doesn't matter. There will, both sides will end up feeling the same way I think they have for the past, I would say, not only the 30-plus days of the shutdown, but probably the past several years. And that is how these people on both sides of the aisle of this issue, how the president frames it for his constituency and how members of Congress frame it for their constituency. What actually is going to come out of it won't be that much clearer. I mean, the path, if you look at it 100 years from now, probably this was barely a blip.
Right.
But clearly, that's why we're seeing this, these change orders. Again, I'll speak in rhetorical terms. If this were a construction project, this would be already exorbitant because of the change orders in terms of the reframing.
If you're an average Hoosier, you hear, oh, okay, there's a temporary deal. At least the government will be open for a little while. People will get paychecks. All of these ripple effects might be at least temporarily sated. But given what the two sides are talking about and given how the border funding issue seems to be unresolved at this point, even with this temporary deal, would you have hope that we're not back where we started in 3 weeks?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't see anything changing in 3 weeks except that there's a, you know, a small moment of, you know, paying and catching up on some things. The fact is that, you know, I think the president was being held more to blame in the situation when you looked at polling and things like that. And I would say Democrats won this battle. You know, but I do not know who's going to win the war because neither side is blinking on that.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Eismiller email and text alerts. This week's question, who's the most to blame for the federal government shutdown? President Trump, congressional Democrats, or congressional Republicans? Last week's question, should the General Assembly force DCS to hire more caseworkers if the agency isn't meeting its caseload standards? 74% say yes, they should. 26% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Senate this week passed a bill to require high school students to pass a civics test before they graduate.
Republican Senator Dennis Cruz's proposal would use the test U.S. immigration uses for people who wish to become citizens. Indiana already requires high schoolers take a civics course to graduate, but Cruz says the class is not enough. The bill says students would have to get at least 60 questions correct out of the 100-question online test. Cruz previously tried and failed to pass a civics test requirement in 2015. This week, his bill cleared the Senate 31-17.
Nikki Kelly, there are obviously some who don't like this idea, at least 17 people that we know of. What was their, you were on the floor while this debate was happening, what was their objection?
I mean, I think it comes down to people, A, it's another high stakes test. You know, it's, you know, you got to pass this test or you don't graduate. And then on top of that, it's a mandate, which obviously many Republicans are not fond of government mandates being shoved down to the local level. So I was actually surprised that it wasn't a little closer.
Yeah, this failed a few years ago. It's obviously got more success now, though it remains to see what the House will do with this. Speaker Brian Bosma was noncommittal, I would say, at this point. What's your sense of, I mean, is this something that people think generally will support?
You'd hope so, I guess, on one level. You look at some of the data, and there are plenty of measurements out there. There's the Indiana Civic Health Index, for instance, which has been conducted now for several years, which with the backing of the Indiana Supreme Court, the Indiana Bar Association, and numerous academic units within IU and other institutions, that shows basically Indiana, if you think we're bad in terms of our smoking rates and how much belly fat we carry around and all the other measures that Hoosiers are typically dinged on, we're even worse in many ways on this. In terms of civic engagement, in terms of voter registration, in terms of voter turnout. And it's not as if anybody in the country, there's no state that's waving a flag saying, I mean, this
really
is like the best of the bad. So when you look at where we are as a society and how polarized we are and how unable we are to function, it seems to me that, and maybe this is naive, that some introduction of a basic notion of the structure of our government and what the founding fathers had in mind when they set things up the way they did would probably serve us well. It wouldn't hurt us, I wouldn't imagine, in terms of advancing the dialogue. Having said that, yeah, I know, there's a school of thought that nobody wants to see additional mandates, aside from the high-stakes educational aspect of it. The notion this is a country of freedom, why should I need to, you know, just as I don't need to salute the flag or sing the national anthem, why do I need to do a civics test?
Well, so that, and for students' sake, I mean, I want to point out, all these items they're talking about, how many members are on the U.S. Supreme Court, why did we have the Civil War, who was the first president, I mean, those are things that are taught in history and government throughout high school. And kids take tests and quizzes, and they pass those courses, and apparently that doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that's what I want to ask to you, Jennifer, which is, I think everybody kind of agrees, we all, I think, as a society could probably do to understand civics, government, and how it works a little better, but is requiring high school students to pass this 100-question test the way to do that?
I do not think it's too much to ask that before our students graduate and start voting and go on and work in this world, that they know the basics about our country's history and our government and how it works. And it's not like we're requiring them to get 90%. They just have to get 60 out of 100 questions correct to pass, and they can take it over as many times as they need to.
Yeah, it's an online test.
To pass. And so, you know, unless you're just against, you know, mandated tests, which I think some of our folks are, and maybe why they voted against it, I don't think this is too much to ask. I think it's probably very popular among, you know, voters across the state, and I think it's fairly simple.
Yeah, is it too much to ask?
I don't think anyone's against the notion that we need more civic engagement and more civic knowledge in our schools. I do think that you have to consider what teachers would say, and you know, do they want another test? Do they feel like maybe this bill says that they're not teaching civics to a standard that is adequate already? You know, I would love to talk to more teachers to hear what they would like to say, because they are in practice the people who have to take the time out of their class to, you know, do an additional test that's tied to graduation rates, that's tied to funding. Is it tied to their performance? Is that tied to their own personal raise? I mean, there are a lot of factors. I mean, it sounds great, and we should have students who are civically engaged, but with how many different things that are tied to a student's performance in our schools right now, we should look at it very clearly.
Well, victims of fertility fraud would have the right to sue in civil court under legislation approved by an Indiana Senate committee this week. But that committee also removed the criminal element of the bill.
Jacoba Ballard was already an adult when she discovered she has at least 50 half-siblings. That's because her mother was one of dozens of women who went to Indianapolis fertility doctor Donald Klein. Klein used his own sperm for years rather than anonymous donors. Ballard says what Klein did was devastating.
Let's be honest, in regards to the past, most of us may never know if we have interacted or involved romantically with our own siblings.
The bill originally created a new crime of fertility fraud, but Republican Senator Mike Young got that language removed. Young says existing fraud and deception laws already apply.
Because it has a name on it, that changes the elements, the evidence? No.
Other lawmakers could add the criminal language back into the bill later in the process.
John Schwana, some legal experts say current laws don't apply. They contradict what Senator Young says. So from a perception standpoint, why wouldn't just going ahead with the criminal penalty be a no-brainer here?
I'm glad you talked about perception, because from a legal standpoint, I would have no idea how to answer that question. I mean, as a practical matter, you could take anything in statute and probably find two camps to argue every
point. And there are legal
point.
Experts here who disagree.
Right. And that, again, nothing new. I mean, but this is such a anytime you deal with issues of fraud misconception in terms of providers, it's going to be heated. But you talk about something that's as highly charged and as personal and as emotional as this, I'm not surprised that it has everybody sort of saying, we need to think about this. Maybe there are ramifications that we don't. But you're exactly right. I think on the surface, maybe if I thought about it longer, I could come up with an argument against why it's needed, but it seems to me that perception would be on the side of this, of that component of the bill.
So the way this was stripped out in the committee was a little bizarre in that you had the chair of the committee saying, I made a deal with a fellow chairman, in this case that fellow chairman Mike Young, to take out the criminal element so that the bill could move. Otherwise, the bill wasn't going to go anywhere. Now it goes to the full Senate. Is there anything they can do to stop? I mean, isn't this going to get added back in at that point?
I mean, there were multiple members just on that committee alone who were, A, annoyed that it got taken out, and moot, and they want to add it back in on the on a second reading amendment. So, I mean, I would think, you know, Mike Young will make a spirited, you know, argument against, as he does. But I just, as far as, like, we were talking about the no-brainer perception, I mean, good Lord, these women were taken advantage of. And, you know, I can't imagine that this wouldn't be an easy vote to, in the future, hold someone responsible for something that.
Even if Mike Young is right, even if you can use current law to prosecute someone like Donald Klein, why not just put this language in to make it even more clear?
Great question. I don't understand why you wouldn't double up on that. It didn't stop anyone from taking a, even though we were required to pass a budget, we are every 2 years by law. We went through the constitutional amendment process to make sure that that was doubled up and locked tight. Just simply adding a criminal element for to protect women who generally bear the emotional brunt of infertility as it is, to protect them from something like this ever happening again, it's a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, no-brainer from three of our four. I'm assuming you're going to agree with that one or no? Should this just be put in as a, again, as a perception issue, if nothing else?
I don't see any downside to having that clarification, and I think prosecutors said that it would have helped them had they been able to. I mean, Senator Young is very particular on code issues, and so I'm not surprised. But I do think that there are a lot of people who want to see the criminal
element
added to it. Yeah.
Well, Republican Senator Jim Merritt is pushing legislation that would undo much of Indiana's recent criminal code reform.
Merritt says his bill aims to increase penalties for the worst offenders, but it also increases potential sentences for the lowest felony level. It also takes away discretion from judges to suspend sentences of a wide range of felony offenders. Merritt says the measure is a response in part to violent crime in Indianapolis. The Republican senator is currently making a bid for Indianapolis mayor. A Senate committee took testimony on the legislation this week, though it did not vote on it. The bill comes with a hefty price tag, at least $50 million a year cost at the Department of Correction.
Jennifer Hollowell, is this policymaking in support of a mayoral campaign?
I don't think so. I don't think that's the reason for it. And certainly on these kinds of issues, Senator Merritt has been an advocate both for tougher sentencing and for treatment and other options for drug addicted folks versus drug dealers. And so these are the kinds of issues that he has worked on for many, many years. And if you look at news clips last year, he was talking about this same thing long before he was considering running for mayor. So I don't think that's what's motivating it. I think, as he said, he thinks that House Bill 1006, the criminal code reform from a few years ago, needs modification. Not everyone thinks that it is a done deal, and he thinks that there are issues where we need to make tougher sentences for drug dealers and then allow more options to treatment and deference for people who are addicted to drugs, including he has lots of other bills that would add treatment centers for addiction.
Is this bill a good idea?
I think that back in 2015, when both parties came together, they saw the lower level sentences for and penalties as a win. They saw discretion for judges as a win. This bill would take that away or would drastically change it. Both parties worked really hard on this, and I think when you line up the stars, you will see that this does mimic his rhetoric on the campaign trail, so I do think it is related to his campaign.
Very, very, very quickly, do you think this has a chance of going very far?
I don't think so. I think given the 2 years of study that went into that, just a one bill flat reversing most of it would be unpalatable.
Right. Well, finally, we end on a sad note. Longtime host of this program, Jim Shella, lost his wife Connie this week after a long illness. Connie was an incredible person, and all of us here at the show and the station want to send our love and condolences to Jim and his family. We're all thinking about you. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.